just to explain, for the uninitiated, Good Charity, Bad Charity, the podcast which looks into how charities operate and how they succeed and how they fail and hopes to get good practice out. Is that a good description of us?
Yeah, I think it is, because what we are saying is, look, we're not looking to open up horrendous stories, but what we're looking to do is trying to find where best practice can be evolved and fed into a number of different charities.
My name's David Prest.
My name's Gavilla McGiven.
And I'm Keith Davis.
We've got a very good guest today, Sue Tibbles, who is the chief exec of the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. More of her first. But Camilla, you've something to confess. You've been inside.
I have been inside. I've been in Wandsworth Prison last week. I was there because some of the prisoners, were doing a theatrical project, a devised piece. They work with a writer, with a theatre group that we are thinking as a funder of maybe funding.
You've got a list of demands there.
I have a list of demands. Ominous. This is what I was listed, as it were. Yeah. So it's an all-male prison. So I am told, if you can see up it, down it, or through it, don't wear it. And the items below are restricted, so please don't bring them with you. No jewellery, which I had figured out in advance, but I wasn't sure about my designer handbag and what that might be used for. The usual mobile phones and memory sticks, etc. No illegal drugs, no tools. So I took my tape measure out of my handbag, which I always have because you never know when you might see a nice settee. And
oh my goodness.
I'm not sure why, but I'm not supposed to bring any blue tack in. So if anybody has any ideas about what nefarious practices I might do with blue tack, please write it on a postcard. We went into what was the church, I would guess, and six or seven prisoners at the front of the room with devised pieces. They had worked with a writer. They had talked about themselves, which I think is extremely difficult for somebody to do in that situation, and especially when they often had told no one else. Family would be ringing them from home or vice versa, and they would be saying, it's fine here on the farm, because fundamentally they hadn't told anybody that they were in prison.
Right.
But at the end of it, the big question for me, I mean, okay, it's a joke about the blue tech, but the big question for me was, what happens afterwards? And I don't know what the answer to that is. And as a funder, I'm looking at, should I be involved with the theatre company? Is it therapy? That's then not theatre.
And Keith, you've had some involvement as well, I think, in American prisons, the American prison system. Is that right?
Yeah. Look, one of my mentors in the past, unfortunately, is dead now. We did a lot of work in young offenders.
Yeah.
And one of the young lads there, when asked what he wanted to do when he got out, and he said, well, I wanted to get a job. We said, well, okay, well, what sort of job do you want? And he went, well, I want any job. And then said, well, what else? He said, oh, I'd like a nice car, sort of thing. You know, well, what sort of nice car? Oh, well, any car really would do. And the third thing he said was, and I'd like a girlfriend. And the question again was, what sort of girlfriend? It was like, well, any girlfriend. With that sort of vision coming out, what's he going to end up with? Any old job, any old car, and maybe any old girlfriend. And it's that lack of that positive vision, but it may be because they've been browbeaten.
One of the things that's talked about a lot in the sector is impact assessment. It's talked about everywhere. If you can prove impact, how do you decide what impact some intervention is going to have before you've actually had it? Well, one thing is you look at need. The charity that I'm involved with exists for relief of need in the parish. If what we fund comes out of need, and if it comes out of our aims, if it fits with those, then it's almost a no-brainer. But something like a theatre piece has an overall impact on all of us, but does it have a greater impact on prisoners? And how do we measure that? And there is a whole science over measuring impact.
Charities are hitting that all over the country, probably all over the world,
yep.
About, okay, so what is the social return on that investment?
So we talk about images that have kick-started charities and charity giving, but there's another thing, the iconic individual, the inspirational figure, the real leader who comes from nowhere, who creates a movement, who creates a charity. And today we are going to be talking very much about one of those figures. And Camilla, I want you to introduce someone who you had quite a lot of dealings with in your early start in the charity sector. Tell us about her.
When Sue Tibbles joins us, I've never met her, but as far as I'm concerned, she arrives with a halo because she is the chief exec of the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. And I remember Sheila McKechnie. I did actually meet her. I certainly remember her on the television in the 80s. An incredibly no-nonsense woman on things like Newsnight, talking a huge amount of sense about homelessness.
This is a daft argument. I mean, let's take a nurse in London starting on £140
a week. It's not a daft argument, it is actual reality.
Right, but look, you're saying if people cannot afford the rents in an area or cannot afford to buy in an area, then they should move somewhere else where they can.
Yes.
No, right. Well, what are you going to do about nurses in London, bus drivers in London, people running in, people in restaurants? A third of the taxable population in this country are earning less than £125 a week.
She was the chief exec from 1985 of Shelter.
So this is the homeless charity.
Yep. And she was a down-to-earth Scot. She didn't wring her hands. She didn't wring her tissues. She just talked logic. I really responded to that. And it was the first time I had ever sort of sat down, worked out my finances and thought, I can give so much a month. So I took out a direct debit, and I can't say I thought a lot more about it. And one day I got invited. Shelter was having a do. It was in Parliament, and we all rocked up. And it turned out, with my little sum every month, I was a major funder. So I was introduced, we were introduced as major funders. And I thought, this is incredible. I know nothing about this. And I started to follow her. And I watched what she was doing. And she went on to the Consumers Association. I think she started Which. She then became a Dame. And I want to hear what Sue's got to say about her. And how did they start this foundation? And where did this come from? And why did they get all this wonderful ambassadorship, which they have?
Sue Tibbles, OBE, is a campaigner, a strategist, a commentator who's worked at the forefront of the social change sector for over 20 years now. She's the former chief executive of the campaigning charity, the Women's Sport and Fitness Foundation, now Women in Sport, and was at one stage also women's campaign manager at The Body Shop, working alongside the charismatic founder of The Body Shop, Anita Roddick. She's now the chief executive of the Sheila McKechnie Foundation, which you're going to hear a lot about. But first of all, you're clearly drawn to organisations run by charismatic women.
Well, absolutely. I mean, who wouldn't be? I haven't consciously sought them out, although I guess, to be fair, most of my campaigning life has been focused on women's equality, women's rights. And as you say, I was there leading the campaign centred on women at The Body Shop, and what an amazing place to be.
This is where, this is in the sort of heyday of the organisation.
That's right. I mean, interestingly, I joined just before the company floated, so just before the real financial pressures that pushed it really into the mainstream. But when I arrived, it still was this extraordinarily creative and vibrant and radical organisation. I led a global campaign on body image and self-esteem. I sat along the animal rights campaigner. And, you know, Anita was an absolute force of nature, so passionate, very sort of Italian, and that, you know, she could also be quite hard to read and a little unpredictable, which could make life difficult. But essentially, it was an extraordinary business. And one thing that I am still really sort of mindful of is that the people that most understood and lived that brand and those sets of values were the people that worked in the shops and that bought the stuff.
Camilla, you were a big fan of The Body Shop at one stage, apparently.
I just... peppermint foot lotion. I can hear it in my brain. I think I did buy it. I think that I remember the recycling. You could take your peppermint foot lotion thing back and have it refilled pink.
Good.
Oh, yeah. Pink peppermint.
So well, that's ahead of its time, isn't it?
Yeah.
With plastic campaigns now.
I think you call that an early adopter.
Yeah, definitely.
So I, you know, take great pride in being an early adopter.
I think, if I might say that, I don't think Anita Roddick has been given the credit that she is due. I'm not sure the establishment could understand, never mind cope, never mind give her the accolade that she's due.
Disruptors is kind of what we're talking about, isn't it? We're talking about Anita Roddick, but the main person that we're also going to talk about is Sheila McKechnie, whose foundation, Sue, you now are the chief executive of. Tell us, first of all, you never met Sheila McKechnie. Tell me what sort of the values that she imbued, which now feed through to the organisation that you head up.
She was absolutely single-minded. I mean, unbelievably single-minded, incredibly hardworking, very detailed, understood every single brief to a fault. So even when she was running very big organisations with very big teams, she was always ahead of most of them. But what's also interesting about her is that her friends and her networks crossed every divide. Political divides left and right, private sector, charity sector. She sat on a Bank of England committee. She sat on an architecture committee. She was running charities and raising the game of civil society voice.
We're really sort of focusing on the campaigning role, a charity with a campaigning role, aren't we? Which is what the foundation now does. You try and inspire social change. You try and develop social change, working with different players, with different other charities as well. And is there something about the nature of campaigning, which means that, you know, it attracts a certain type of chief executive who is more passionate and is prepared to go on Newsnight and disrupt a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. We had an event where we discussed the concept of activist leaders with a group of people from the sector. And the view there was, well, of course, you've got to run your organisation. You can't just get someone who's literally just mad about issues. But that even at the recruitment stage, how do you actually test for that? It's quite interesting.
We're about good or bad thing. I can already see that Keith is champing at the bit on this one. Keith, professionalism in the charity sector, good or bad?
Yeah, it's got to be good. I mean, it's got to be good, but there's got to be this balance. You know, you need someone running out the front with the flag that's waving it around. And I always used to argue with me, you know, I'm good at running with the flag. I'm not a good sweeper up behind me. And it's about having that mix, which is where the challenge comes in of chair and chief exec or MD, you know, and the part that you were saying before, that it some people are pigeonholed too easily.
How do you define a campaign, though, in your head?
My personal understanding of campaigning is social change. So partly because of the campaigns that I've run. I mean, you know, trying to shift norms around women and self-esteem, for example, well, you can't do that through changing the law. So that was always around influencing mainstream media, commercial advertising. What I've understood coming to the Sheila McKechnie Foundation is that in lots of charities, they really understand campaigning to be policy and public affairs and have this much narrower conception. But if you were to ask a member of the public, they would think probably of advertising campaigns or election campaigns.
Yep.
But campaigning needs to be defended because we're also very aware that it's become almost a sort of dirty word.
Yeah.
And that's also dangerous, that it becomes somehow illicit and prohibited, because in its simplest terms, it just means to change something and to stand up for something.
Mm. Do you think, in a way, there's something else, isn't it? Because I can imagine if I'm running a charity, I'm protective of my area. I want to grow that charity, yes, but and sometimes you may lose focus of what you're actually trying to do, which is charities can actually be so successful they put themselves out of business effectively, can't they? Which I'm guessing is the end result for some campaigns.
Yeah, and particularly if yours is a, you know, well, let's look at UKIP, for example. You know, that's the best example of all social putting. It won, and it has gone out of business. So, you know, that's probably correct. Most charities actually have a much broader mission that they work to. So people quite often say that, don't they? We'll know we're successful when we're redundant. I used to be chair of the Fawcett Society, which goes back through time to the campaign for women's votes. And it's quite hard to know exactly when Fawcett's work to achieve an equal society will be done. So I think it's unusual that charities are working on such a specific campaign goal. But there are people in the sector who are rethinking in a really fundamental way, how can we achieve our mission, or are we pursuing it the best way? So, for example, the chief exec of Scope at the moment, Mark Atkinson, they've divested themselves of all of their services in order to become what he calls an enabling organisation. So they're a £100 million-plus charity. They used to run numerous residential homes and care services. Yep. The judgment of him and his board was that actually they could use that money more effectively as an enabling organisation, that other organisations were better placed to run services. So they've cut, I think it's 30% of their income and 60% of their staff. And I'm always someone who finds it quite frustrating. People always say we just need more money, because sometimes that's true, but very often it isn't.
Do you think, though, that there's a campaigning is for some people in the charity sector a bit of a dirty word? Do you think that are the campaigning sides of charities, or campaigning charities, slightly looked down upon by other people in the third sector?
Certainly from outside the sector. So we know that with the current administration, there absolutely has been a challenge to charity campaigning. Measures like the Lobbying Act that have been introduced that have really unseated charity campaigning.
Right, yeah.
And so we're right at the heart of all of that, trying to unravel it, because in truth, what sits behind it really is a perception from the government that the sector is full of left-wingers who are antithetical to their politics. And
how have you picked that up? I'm always curious.
I will tell you. And it's not irrational, you know. I mean, it would be completely wrong to say the sector's party political, because we all know that that's illegal. People are very, very clear about that. But I think it isn't surprising that the sector tends to attract people in who are the kinds of people who similarly might have gone into social work or teaching, and those industries tend to be sort of a bit left-leaning. But there's a sensitivity where I think, well, this is how the line would go, that the perception would be that particular bigger charities that have got quite sophisticated public affairs operations are using public money to go into government and lobby in their own interests to sustain themselves. The problem with it is that if you start to contest that kind of activity, people get anxious about all kinds of other activities. And we are just about to publish some research that shows incontrovertibly that the Lobbying Act and other government measures are chilling charity campaigning.
You made an interesting point in one of the articles I read, which said that a lot of people are angry about a lot of things, okay, and you've got to find an authentic voice. Now, I think that for me was a really interesting when you look at the diversity of charities at the moment from one end to the other. And it's about how can we work with these charities to get an authentic voice that will make things different.
Mm-hmm.
What's your view on that?
There's a risk for the sector, because, again, I think one of the challenges that is being put down is that, you know, the professional classes in charities are self-interested and they're not really speaking authentically for beneficiaries, and indeed beneficiaries who do better to advocate for themselves. And there is a risk there, because I think the reason why civil society has developed is because actually if you have citizens just organising and advocating on their own behalf without any formal organisation or sometimes intermediaries, that introduces far greater problems.
Yeah.
So we absolutely need civil society there. Some organisations are really brilliant at putting, I like to call them people sometimes, you know, otherwise they're called service users or beneficiaries. We're talking about people.
Clients.
We've just been talking about exactly this. Yeah.
You know,
really,
but the people, to put them really front and centre of their work. So whether that's the way in which services are being designed or indeed in their campaigning. So Mind, for example, ran a brilliant mental health campaign where most of the advocates were people that have mental health problems, and it was really effective.
Yeah, saw that. Mm.
But this is trust, isn't it, actually? And you know, to move us on to a different area, you know, charities and trust is a big, big issue at the moment.
Yeah.
We've had scandals involving major charities which have damaged their bond with their funders, the public, possibly irreparably, who knows? I mean, this must be something which concerns the people that you talk to all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's literally not a day goes by where someone else isn't taking a lump out of charities. I mean, it's a complete free-for-all. And to be honest, what I'm most struck by is how easy it is to level the charge and how poorly equipped charities are to defend themselves. In fact, there's a terrible story about the Dogs Trust, who have been accused by a journalist in the Mirror, actually, of trying to block some legislation that's going to stop puppies being sold or something. And you can just see from reading it that they have been just totally misrepresented. It's almost like a stitch-up. There are legitimate challenges that face the sector around fundraising. I think the nature of fundraising with chugging and so on has definitely been... It's been to the detriment of the brand of the sector, if you could say that, and of individual organisations. But also, it does need to be understood that the Oxfam story, when that broke about the safeguarding, that story had been in the media 7 years previously. Yeah. Everyone in the sector knows that. This wasn't new news. It was a placed story. It was weirdly sort of off the back of Me Too and this public appetite around women's sexual safety. So sort of an odd, unintended consequence of a generally positive, I would say, campaign.
Yeah, I think you're right that it's partly our turn.
Mm.
But I'm also struck by the fact that in government, if you've got a minister for something, they usually champion that. So the minister for education will champion education. When you've got the minister for charities who's slagging off the sector at the same time as the House of Lords comes out with a report last year which says charities are the eyes, ears, and conscience of society, and then you wait for what government is going to do about that report, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait, and you think, well, where's the advocate? Why isn't the Minister for Charities advocating?
There has been, you know, an explicit sort of anti-charity agenda. So from ministers and from the regulators. So famously, it was the quote from a former Charity Commission chair, or he was on the board, I think, but to stick to the knitting. Mm. Which sort of rather captured the idea that, yeah, you know, dole out the soup, but don't tell us what you think. Yeah. And that's been certainly the mood music. And the Lobbying Act has been the sort of the sharp end of it.
In your own work in trying to facilitate social change, how do you get over that political climate now, that negativity around what you're doing?
So what we have done is conducted research, because one of the things, so the new charity minister actually is a very different proposition to her predecessor, Tracy Crouch. I think she is definitely much more open-minded, more positively disposed.
But good to hear.
I met her early on and she said to me, you know, the Lobbying Act is awkward, but it's not really stopping anyone doing anything. So we've gone to ask that question, is it stopping charities from doing anything? And the evidence is clear, it absolutely is. It's stopping charities doing certain activities, it's changing the content of communications. So we are approaching this from an evidence-based point of view to say, This is what's happening with the regulation. It's not workable. There was a sort of sense in which everyone was just self-censoring irrationally, that if they just followed the regulation, it would be straightforward. Whereas in fact, the regulation is literally impossible to interpret. So we're very hopeful, actually, that this, you know, more collaborative approach will elicit a different response.
I'm intrigued coming back to social change. I mean, you know, that's that great game, isn't it? Where are we going to be going in 10 years and 20 years? And you must have these conversations with people when you genuinely feel, you know what, this is going to be something good. We can get to that tipping point where society can change its values and its views on something. Where do you see that happening in the next 5 years, the next 10 years?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I suppose at my age, it's really fascinating how you see things that were really the preoccupations of campaigners, actually activists. You know, I was a young sort of feminist activist. We used to campaign around tampons and sanitary towels and around toxic shock syndrome and flushing sanitary towels down the loo. And trying to campaign around that stuff because of the sort of concern about talking about menstruation meant it was almost impossible. Mm. There are now myriad campaigns around menstruation, yeah, and periods, and a young woman won one of our campaign awards this year, Amika George. She runs a campaign called Free Periods, which is about women who can't afford sanitary protection being able to be given free Sampro. And actually, she couldn't make the awards because she had to do her history revision for the next day. And her father came. And I was so struck by this. He was a really delightful, quite sort of conservative dressed guy, an Asian family, who came and spoke about his daughter's campaigning around menstruation. And I just thought, oh my God, how this has changed. But then on much bigger things. So in fact, you know, the Secretary of State for DCMS, Matthew Hancock, was talking on Wednesday about how well-being is going to be built into GDP. Yeah. You know, again, economists, progressive economists, have been talking about that for decades. It suddenly hit the mainstream.
Which presumably will then fire up all sorts of different levels of interpretation, whether it's about how we treat mental health.
Absolutely.
Or it's about
it opens the door, doesn't it, to a very, very different way of doing everything from commissioning to, you know, managing the economy on a sort of macro scale. But where's it all going to go? I mean, I think a lot of people would say it's at a real pincer point, isn't it, between our ability to really engage with the big long-term challenges, whether that's environmental sustainability, growing inequality, integration and so on, this sense of fracturing. And it's so live, isn't it? It's just very, very live between... and polarised. I mean, I think that for many campaigners feels like a real challenge, what to do about that. That I think partly because of the way social media works, people get forced into these very reductive, simplistic positions, which, based on what we said earlier, generally you meet in the middle.
I'm interested, though, to ask you from your charity's point of view about how a lot of other charities, the smaller charities, can access and benefit from your charity.
We do training around the country, which is an introduction to campaigning. It has to be quite wide-ranging because it might be that they're trying to do some sort of public campaigning, or it might just be they want to know how to better manage relationship with local elected representatives or local authority. Mm. But the whole idea that campaigning is a discipline that you would support is a new idea. Mm. The Sheila McKechnie Foundation were the first. There are now a few of us doing it. Mm-hmm. But we're running a project at the moment called the Social Change Project that basically responds to the fact that in the United States, in the US, there is a huge industry that exists to help civil society understand how it can go about its business well. And there is virtually nothing here.
One final thing. Of all the campaigns you've been involved with, what's the one thing that you have done which you can lie back on your deck chair and say, bloody hell, I did that.
Yeah, just to be very honest, you quite often don't have that feeling. But I must say, working in women's sport, I'm not a sporty person. I was, you know, a kid that got into dance. And for me, sport was, you know, my brother's playing football and telling me to get out of the way. So I'm not a sports enthusiast, but I took the job running what's now called Women in Sport. Because I could just see that gender was playing a huge part in how sport played out in this country, whether it was participation, funding, media profile. And when I took that job, which is about 10 years ago now, women's sport was basically viewed as a compliance issue, as an equality problem. Yeah. You had to go through your activities.
Diversity.
It was all of that. We worked really hard to change that narrative. So, in fact, we banned the language of equality because you just knew that everyone fell asleep. It's wrong, but they do. And so we talked about the biggest space for sport to grow. It was actually what's called framing. Let's change the frame around the debate. All the sports in this country are funded to grow their sport. So actually, suddenly, you're of interest to them. We set ourselves up as experts in the women's market. How do you get women more engaged in taking part in these sports? We did a lot as well, more on a sort of traditional campaign front, about the lack of money. We showed the first evidence of sponsorship of women's sport, which was 0.05% into women's sport. There's nothing like some strong stats. Anyway, a whole case was made, a whole load of people mobilised, and then 2012 came along and it was a classic tipping point moment. Women's sport has transformed in this country in a relatively small period of time. All the major sports broadcasters, who are really the ones who held the key, are now showing women's sport. And I remember talking to all of them and saying, you need to broadcast more women's sport. And they would say, well, we can't because the market and the demand isn't there. We did the research with sports fans, most of whom are men, and they said, we'll watch any sport. We don't care what sex they are if it's good sport. And then the women's FA Cup final at Wembley, was it 40,000 people? And you were like, argument nailed. People want to watch women's sport. And so if I see girls running around now in their rugby kit, I'm just like, yes!
You can claim credit for every gold medal, every moment that someone stands on a podium.
And, you know, I still know nothing about sport, and don't ask me about the offside rule or any of that, because I've been useless.
That is fantastic. I'm an ex-director of leisure services in Australia, and I have to say, 30 years ago, one of my development officers, a lady called Michelle, came and said, I'm going to start a women's rugby team in Hull. And I went, you're bloody mad. You know, it won't work. And yet from that, and I watched the women's rugby the other day, and it's fantastic.
Isn't
you
it?
Know, and I'm really pleased. And good luck to the women's bobsleigh team at getting their funding next time, because they beat the men out of all this rubbish that goes on about, you know, well, we're only going to fund male athletes in that way. So I was celebrating them when they got there. So, you know, best for them as well.
Yeah.
It's been fantastic having you here, Sue. Good luck to you in everything that you're doing in this difficult, this challenging environment. This is something that we're going to be taking away and talking about, I'm sure, on the podcast in the future. But thank you, Sue Tibbles of the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, there's something really interesting going on, isn't there? And it's scary. It's about the political environment. I was just amazed hearing Sue there talking about the difficulties that she's facing, that other charities are facing at the moment from all sides, and the political climate that she's pitching into. We're in this, we think, cosy charity land. Everything's fine and dandy, but outside it's not, is it?
No, it's not. And you know, obviously where she's coming from is about change and getting that social change. And that's the world that charities work in daily. So it was really refreshing to hear that not only that she's seen charities working at the ground level, but she's also involved with some charities that is trying to support them right at the top, by dealing with all the key players, the decision makers out there in the world.
But the idea of trying to change the environment with slow bits of nudging here and there, and then you get to a tipping point. This is hard work, isn't it?
It's a hard slog. But I think that from what I pick up from Sue, she understands that totally. Her language is about together, bringing people together. It is not about confrontation. It's not about divides. It's not about saying the government is against us. She used a really interesting word, framing. You reframe the debate. So you don't get into the question time mode, the kind of this is my defensive position and that's your defensive position and now we're going to slog it out in the ring. We're not going to do that. We're going to talk about whatever the issue is, whatever our campaign is, in a different language. And boy, do I want to know more about that.
And isn't that wonderful, that notion that she is contented because of what happened, because every time she sees women's sport now, which is fantastic. We didn't get a chance for you to talk about your role in the great the great women's sport advance. And Camilla, I know you're an expert at various sports. We'll come on to those in future episodes, I'm sure. My name's David Prest.
My name's Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
We are Good Charity, Bad Charity. Thank you very much for listening. Some music will be playing underneath me at this stage to add drama and excitement to the end of the programme. So we give praise and thanks to Dan Hardoon, who's been our producer today.
Here.
We say to you, if you want to become a friend of this podcast, email us at this instance, info@whistledown.net. We'll pass you on the details. You can become a friend or a sponsor. You can come and use our facilities at Whistledown Studios. We're on every podcast platform. Please do care and share us, rate and review, tell your friends, reeled ones, stuffed ones, social media ones, we don't care. Spread the word.